Senate Special Budget Committee to order for June 23rd, 2005. Got four items on the agenda. And we're going to start off with the Economic and Community Development Department's budget, Senate Bill 5615. LFO.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I will do is walk you through the packages. Please stop me if you have any questions as I move through them. The first set of adjustments are the standard adjustments that you see in all budgets. The first is package 090, which were BAM analyst adjustments, which were reductions to services and supplies from Smart Buy, and also a reduction to special payments in the Oregon Development Fund, equivalent to the standard inflation allowance in the agency's essential budget level. Package 801 is the base personal services adjustment for PERS and the Attorney General rate reduction. The next package, package 810, is to provide other funds expenditure limitation for a grant received by the Arts Commission. A copy of the grant information is attached to your packet. Or should be. Yes, it is. It's next to the last. Turning to page 2, the next adjustments are the Senate chair adjustments. Package 812 reduces $1 million of the $4 million in lottery funds, which the commission identified as carryover in the strategic reserve fund. This does reduce the capacity of strategic reserve by $1 million. The co-chairs also eliminated $600,000 in funding for community assistance grants. If you recall, that was an item that was very low on the priority list. Package 813 provides staff support and services and supplies for the Innovation Economy, Senate Bill 838 that you passed last week, and that includes $280,000 of lottery funds and one position. There is handed out to you for your information a memo from the department explaining what the components are of that package. Package 101, industrial lands, is adjusted in this budget to reduce the proceeds to $45 million, actually $46.1 million, including issuance costs, and to reduce the governor's budget request of $3.9 million in lottery funds debt service to $1.9 million, and to shift the debt service onto other funds. The other fund's revenue source is interest earnings on lottery-backed bond reserves and proceeds. And there is a note about what the roll-up of the debt service cost will be on a bonding capacity of that amount. I would note that there is the assumption that there would probably be approximately $2 million in other funds interest earnings that would be available to help offset some of that cost. Package 104 deletes the funding that the governor requested to increase the amount that is provided to regional and rural investment by $3.5 million. And Package 105 deletes the package. This budget deletes the package that was that the governor included in this budget for the innovation economy. Again, you funded those costs in Senate Bill 838, and you funded $7 million of the costs in Senate Bill 838, and are providing approximately $1.5 million in Senate Bill 853. And with these budget packages, you have a total agency budget of 457, 255, 561, and 115 FTE.
Very good. Any discussion? Any questions? We've actually gone ahead and compared to the original co-chair's budget, we've added back a significant amount of money in the Strategic Reserve Fund and industrial lands area in particular. Anami stuff, I think we've discussed before. Sarah Morris.
Could we have a little light shed on the industrial land reduction of 15.3 million?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we looked at really two issues. One was what the department identified as being projects that are pretty much ready to go, and the other was what the capacity that could be supported with the other funds, debt service that we identified, and the two fortunately matched up pretty closely.
Further discussion? Motion.
Chair, I don't have any discussion. I just would like to make a comment about the hearings and the budget of this department. I think that sometimes it takes us a while before we get really in tune and organized. And one of the things that has happened in the sessions that I've been in the Capitol is to watch this department struggle with how to do things better. And the industrial lands part of the department, where they actually went out and searched to have a list of those lands, has been a hard project to accomplish. And so there are other things, and I just want to note for the record that sometimes it takes a lot of time and effort, and the department, even in the times that I've been here, and I've been one of the ones that have encouraged them to try to do things better, and I am happy to see that some of that has occurred.
Yeah, it was felt in some of the discussions we had that there was certain critical mass. They've gone out, they've gotten this ball rolling, and well, we can't continue perhaps with this on a sustainability basis this next biennium, roll it all out. Wanted to make sure they could continue to build upon the work they'd already done and recognize that, which made an impression on me anyway. Further discussion on the base budget and the packages as outlined by LFO? None. Chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 5615 to the full committee with a due pass recommendation.
Well, I'll approve the budget packages. We'll get the rest of it. I've got to just take it a bit in front of
it. Being the efficient type of guy I am, Mr. Chair, I move the budget packages as presented by LFO to Senate Bill 5615.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Senator Morris will be a no. Anyone else? Very good. Carried. 3-1. Ending balance review.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the 2005-07 projected other funds ending balance for operations is $1.5 million, or approximately 2 months for operating reserves. The projected other funds ending balance also includes $8 million to reflect the corpus of the Cultural Trust, and the projected non-limited other funds ending balance is $100.4 million, which reflects revolving loan balances and reserves for the bond bank debt service.
Any discussion? Any objection? Motion to approve the funding balances made by Senator Westland. Seeing none, so ordered. Performance measure review.
Mr. Chair, the performance measures are attached. The subcommittee reviewed the performance measures and approved the changes as detailed on the attached report.
Any questions? I thought the performance measures were really pretty good. Questions? Motion? Approve the performance measures?
Mr. Chair, I move the performance measures into 5615.
Discussion? Objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
The next thing that I need from the committee is a motion to approve the Dash 1 amendments. The Dash 1 amendments incorporate Senate Bill 5508, which was the original Economic and Community Development Department budget bill.
Discussion? Motion?
Mr. Chair, I move the amendments as the Dash 1 amendments into 5615.
Thank you. Incorporate 5508 in the budget bill.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Morris.
Do we have a typo on four reference to House bill? Should be a Senate bill.
Yes, I apologize.
Good catch, sir.
And I'll be in objection.
Certainly. Any other objections? Carries 3-1.
Mr. Chair, what's your preference? Would you like me to read through all of the proposed amendments? These amendments simply incorporate the recommendations as presented in the budget packages.
I don't think that's necessary.
Then, Mr. Chair, we would need a motion to approve the amendments as outlined on this sheet to Senate Bill 5615-1.
All right. Chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I...
motion.
The what?
Yes. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, I move the line item appropriations as reflected on page 3 of the LFO budget report items enumerated and bullet pointed under item number 4 into Senate Bill 5615 as amended.
Thank you. Good motion. Objection? One, Senator Morris. Seeing no others, carries 3-1. Final subcommittee action.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 5615 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
To the full Senate Budget Committee with a due pass recommendation. Thank you very much.
That's exactly what I said, Mr. Chair.
Senator Morris is an objection, I would assume. Yes. Thank you, sir. Seeing none, no others, passes 3-1. Thank you very much.
Any carrier?
Carrier. Senator Berger, would you mind carrying this bill?
I would be happy to carry.
Thank you. All right. Next on the agenda is public hearing, possible work session with Senate Bill 173. We've got to changing the guard here, I believe.
Yes.
Give us a few minutes. Maybe you start this, my friend. Are we ready?
Yes.
We will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 173. First, we will entertain a report from staff, if you have one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We have before you Senate Bill 173. The bill would modify criteria for businesses that wish to be certified as emerging small businesses by the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and allow reinstatement of a formerly certified business if the business still qualifies as an emerging small business and has remaining eligibility. The bill would also abolish the emerging small business account within the Consumer and Business Services Fund and establish it in the State Highway Fund. The bill was referred to Senate Business and Economic Development on January 14th. The public hearing was held on March 1st and a work session on April 7th, where it passed out of committee on a 3-0 vote. The bill has no fiscal impact.
Further discussion? Anyone like need to testify on Senate Bill 173?
Yes, Mr. Chair, if you wish to have testimony.
Just something extremely brief for the record. Mr. Marsh would be fine.
Mr. Chair, Mike Marsh from the Department of Transportation. The testimony is coming around to the members. Let me just briefly summarize that this is a bill that expands the definition of emerging small businesses in Oregon. We feel it's critical in order to take advantage of the Oregon Transportation Investment Act and the expansion of work on bridges and highways in Oregon, that we also expand and bring up to date the definitions of emerging small businesses going back to their establishment in 1989. Inflation has made the definition inappropriate. We'd like to make these adjustments in order to expand the involvement for opportunities for small businesses in Oregon. Mr. Chair, I'm open to any questions.
Very good. Any questions? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think it's a good bill. But just a clarification, why are we breaking into Tier 1 and Tier 2? What's the rationale for...
Mr. Chair and Senator Morris would like to make sure that we can take the definition and expand for extremely small business in one tier and those businesses that are involved in a little bit larger size of organization so we can target our assistance for them for the smaller, or what we call medium-sized businesses.
Thank you.
Are there questions? This looked like a thoughtful fix, actually, for some problems.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Morris.
On page 3, line 10, there is, I believe, a typographical error at the end of the sentence.
I'm sorry, sir.
Would staff review that?
Page 3, line 10?
Mm-hmm. By such the bidder.
Okay.
Grammar, sir. Grammar. Excellent. I was assuming some sort of weird legal term. that's what I know these days. Yeah. I'm not even allowed to hear anything. I'm not an attorney. Any other questions or concerns? Seeing none, Chair would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 173 to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation.
Any further discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Senator Morse to carry this. Would you mind, Senator?
Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Next, Senate Bill 1007, relating to intermodal chassis. Hello, Bo. Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You have before you Senate Bill 1007. The bill would require a road safety inspection of an intermodal chassis before the chassis leaves port. It would prohibit removing or tampering with an inspection tag and would prohibit coercion or retaliation against a driver who reports an unsafe intermodal chassis to an inspector. The bill was referred to Senate Transportation on March 4th. A public hearing was held on April 4th and a work session on April 20th, where it passed out on a 3-1 vote. You'll note in your packet that there's a revised fiscal impact statement. We just heard from legislative counsel that they determined that the Port of Portland qualifies as a municipal corporation and therefore falls under the unfunded mandate provision contained in Section 15, Article 11 of the Oregon Constitution. We don't have specific information at this time on the port's estimated annual expenditures for the fiscal, although they did estimate that it would take 15 FTE and some possible construction of a covered building to accomplish the requirements of the bill. We also don't have the total budget of the port, although the 04 general fund budget for the port was $104 million. So that's the information that we have right now.
All right. Further questions? Senator Berger.
Mr. Chair, when we heard this bill in the Transportation Committee, I don't know that there was any eagerness on anybody to get involved in the debate as much as they were concerned about it being a safety issue. And because it was a safety issue, no one wanted to be remiss in not addressing and pursuing so that... If the two parties themselves can alleviate this, that's fine for me, but I do believe that we're remiss if we don't address this as a safety issue, and it's being brought to us as that. And I don't see that there's a denial that there's a safety issue here. Most of it has been focused on the cost of what it would take to remedy the safety issue, which for me, my focus is more on it being a safety issue, and then the cost and those things have to be worked out by the two
entities themselves.
Good comments? Other? Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was there introduced accident incidence rates with these particular chassis in previous testimony?
I don't know how to answer that.
Get someone to come up that would have information to that effect.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir.
Members of the committee, for the record, Pat Egan, representing the Port of Portland. We did talk briefly about that in committee, and Senator Verger is correct. I think no one disagrees. In fact, actually, if I could, I'm just going to pass out a couple of things that I've prepared here. I don't think there's any disagreement that we all have a responsibility for safety, and the Port of Portland, it's in our strategic plan, safety in all of our operations, whether it's aviation, marine, our industrial land, or our relationships with rail. What we had submitted in committee and what is backed up by ODOT data is that there has been one accident in the last 10 years related and attributed to chassis equipment failure. It was a blown tire in 1997, single vehicle accident. The driver walked away. And the bottom line is we do inspections today. We'll continue to do inspections. The truck drivers, under the U.S. Department of Transportation regs that exist today, truck drivers have the responsibility of checking their vehicles before they embark on a trip. Those inspections are done regularly, and I guess I would add it's in everyone's interest, including the companies, the shippers, and everyone involved, that these are safe chassis and that they're on the road and are roadable. The other element of 1007 that I think is worth taking into account here is it only applies to the Port of Portland, and it only applies to container chassis that go through the Port of Portland. Doesn't apply to auto carriers, doesn't apply to log trucks, doesn't apply to flatbeds or virtually any other kind of commercial vehicle. It's only commercial container chassis that come through the Port of Portland. So you could have the same kind of chassis embarking from Salem, one headed to the Port of Tacoma, one headed to the Port of Portland, and the one headed to the Port of Tacoma wouldn't be inspected under 1007, the one headed to Portland would. And if it went back to Woodburn the next day and came up to Portland, it would be inspected again. If it went back to Woodburn, came back to Portland, it would be inspected again. Under this legislation, we would have to inspect it every time, which gets into the cost issue, which is what I'm prepared to talk with you all about today. Significant cost to us. We estimate $3 to $5 million, and we do have information to back that up. And we do believe, because we would be inspecting every one of these and spending 15 minutes or so doing it, we'd have to stage these vehicles. It is Oregon, and we'd have to stage them someplace for the inspection to be done. But bottom line, we absolutely agree that safety is a primary focus. That's why we're happy to say that we have a very good safety record and that we stand by that. A long answer to your question, I appreciate, but we are very concerned with this legislation and hope it does not go forward. Thank you.
Appreciate that very much. Thank you. Anyone else like to come up and testify? Thank you for coming.
Mr. Chairman and Senators, my name is Leo Sundeck. I'm the president of the Longshore Local in Portland. I didn't come here today really to debate the bill itself. I thought we did a lot of that during the debate that took place with the Transportation Committee, and the Transportation Committee passed it with a due pass recommendation to the Senate floor. I think you guys are a subcommittee of the Budget Committee, so I assume that's your focus here. So I'll just respond to that portion relative to the budget, even though I don't necessarily agree with a lot of things that Mr. Egan said.
So noted.
I think you might have a copy in your package, but there was a report put out by a state agency that suggested that the only cost to the state was possibly $5,000 that ODOT may have to incur to do some administrative changes, and they weren't even sure of that. And I responded to that in a letter of May 3, 2005, which I wrote to Senators Courtney Brown, Berger, Metzger, and Posansky. And I don't know if you have a copy of that letter, but I'd be happy to provide it to you. But in any case, the port is wholly, I'm going to be nice about saying this, they're greatly exaggerating the cost here. I mean, to the point where it's almost, I'll just leave it at that. They're exaggerating the cost. To compare the Portland operation to a similar operation involving a multi-user facility, you have an operation in Seattle called, it's Terminal 18. It's operated by Stevedore Services of America. And it's a comparable operation, although it's a much busier operation than Portland's operation. But we're comparing the same type of an operation. The port is suggesting that in order to comply with this legislation, they'd have to employ 10 to 15 more inspectors. Currently, they have one inspector. They operate the facility as far as the input of the gate. They operate only Monday through Fridays. We're not talking about night work or weekend work. We're talking about during the day, straight time work. At Seattle's Terminal 18 facility, they employ seven mechanic inspectors. Now, to give you a comparison, at Seattle's Terminal 18 facility, they process 2,000 containers a day. The Port of Portland processes about 500 containers a day. So where they get 10 to 15 when they're doing only 500 and the Seattle operation is doing 2,000, they're doing it with seven mechanics, I don't know. We anticipate that they need probably two additional mechanics. They don't need a building. Our mechanics work out in the rain. When this has been done in other facilities, they work in the lanes in the rain. So where they come up with a nice building, I don't know. We'd be happy to have a nice building if they want to build one for us, but it's not necessary. To give you an idea, a longshore mechanic, and they're talking about a longshore mechanic earns $34.42 an hour in wages. In addition to that, they're paid $15.62 in benefits. They're not paid that, but that's part of their benefit package. So we're looking at a total benefit or total wage package of $50.04 an hour. Like I said before, the operation we're talking about involves only working Monday through Friday during the day shift. So the annual cost of the port for two additional inspectors would be $208,000. In 2004, the port handled 275,645 containers, and that includes barge and rail movement, not just truck chassis. The added cost equates to 75 cents per container, which is a far cry from what the port is suggesting, that it would be $40 to $50 more per container. Now, just to give you an idea, so that's how far we're off here, 75 cents per can, which would be passed on to the carrier, the person who owns it, the people that own the chassis, which is who really should be paying for this, and that's the beauty of this bill, compared to $40 to $50 that the port is suggesting. So there's a definite difference in the math, as you can see, and I think that the port is just exaggerating it purposely. The argument that the port makes is somehow the port is picked on for this. The port is the one that does the business with the chassis owners. The chassis owners are the steamship companies that call the port. It makes sense then that the port would be the middleman, if you will, in this process, and that's what this bill does. And I'll just stop with an analogy. The port's argument is somehow they're picked on. It's kind of like looking at a dam, and you have one big 10-foot hole in the dam, and you got a whole bunch of little pinholes in the dam. And then you stand up and you say, well, we're not going to fix that 10-foot hole in the dam because we don't have enough money or political influence or, you know, political capital to fix the pinhole, so we'll just leave the 10-foot hole. The port here is a 10-foot hole. This is reasonable legislation. It actually, the port will actually, if they actually did it, would probably make money on it because they would get a lot of the repairs would come through the port. They would actually make money on it. And it would greatly improve the safety of these roads.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony. Mr. Malloy.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tom Malloy with the Joint Council of Teamsters. I kind of have to concur in what my colleague says. These people that are members of the Longshoremen's Union, they're officers, but they're working officers. They're on the job every day. Leal is one of those, president of the union, but still working on the job every day and sees all of these things that he speaks of. It seems to me, and I've heard these arguments going on now for a couple of months, that they are miles apart with respect to their testimony as to what it's going to cost. The other thing that concerns me is this is a safety bill, and nobody's talking about safety. All we're talking about is cost. I just wrap it up there. I have to go along with my colleague here.
Very good. All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate
it. Question, Mr. Chair?
Question, yes, sir. Senator Westland.
Couple, either for Leo or Tom. You still got that $5 bill?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Because I sure don't. Two issues. One, cost. Okay, we're debating it's going to cost this, it's going to cost that. It's going to cost something, you know, a very small amount or a very large amount. I mean, but we are in agreement that it is going to cost something. Is that fair?
Yes.
And what my concern is, Mr. Chair...
Well, let me say... It depends on who you're talking about with respect to cost. I strongly believe that if this gets put into place, the port will actually profit from this. The cost will be to the carriers.
But the bill,
not to the public port authority.
But the bill requires expenditure by the port.
Initially, yes. And they pass that on in the way of tariffs.
But we have no way of knowing what that is. I mean, we haven't seen a business model. We haven't seen a business plan presented either by you or the port, for that matter. So there's some cost to the port. Correct?
I'll just stay with what I said.
And you obviously know where I'm going. I mean, we have very specific laws. This is a public entity. We have very specific laws against unfunded mandates. And from where I sit, good idea or bad idea, not diminishing the safety issue. I want to get into that in a minute. This to me looks like an unfunded mandate. No one has put down in front of me anything that shows that this is actually a profit center for the port. All I've seen is cost. High cost, low cost. One or the other, it's still a cost. That's how I see it. And then secondly, I really would like, and I'm very interested in your opinions as to representations we've heard with regard to the actual safety of the port in the last 10 years, one of these carriages being responsible for one accident, blown tire. Yes? No?
I spoke to that in the Transportation Committee. The reality is that the chassis pool is an unsafe pool. I don't think anybody's disagreed with that. So when the chassis goes on the road, and it has a flat, it has maybe flat tires, it has, lights are out, the brakes don't work, that type of thing. It may not get an accident from point A to point B now, today, but it might tomorrow. The second thing that I said in the Transportation Committee is it depends on how you accumulate the statistics. If I have a truck, I'm driving a truck with a chassis, a trailer, and I'm going to make a corner, And I don't make the corner. Instead, I go straight. You could argue that's driver error, and the port. You know, there is some findings, a number of findings of what they consider driver error. But if you really look at the accident itself, which isn't done, you might find it's bad springs. You know, that type of thing is what caused the accident. So you know, statistics are what they are. Now, I can give you an example of what's been going on in the last week, if you want, because in the last week, what's been going on at the port, and I wasn't going to bring this up, but I might. K-Line, which is a steamship company that doesn't call the port, but it brings containers to the port and uses a space-sharing arrangement with a company called Hanjin. It has a number of chassis that they store in the pool of the port. The port decided that they were basically storing them for free, so the port told them, you need to reduce your the number of chassis you have by at least 100. So K-Line contracted with a company called Northwest Container, who subcontracted with a trucking company called 2B Trucking, to move 100 chassis, relocate them from the port to Northwest Container. Of those 100 chassis, 20 of them were bad order chassis and didn't belong on the road. The port knew it. K-Line knew it. Northwest Container knew it. 2B Trucking knew it. They took the chassis off dock anyway, over the North Marine Drive and over Lombard Street. We complained bitterly to everybody that we could complain to. My business agent did for about 3 days and got one phone number after another, recordings and so forth. I happen to be married to a woman who works for the state of Oregon, and she's not real high up, but she's up there a ways. And so when I had time after about 3 days of this, I called her and asked her, who can I talk to at ODOT? And she gave me the name of a person, and I contacted that person, and within a few minutes, we were getting phone calls from field people in ODOT. They worked with us, and we set up inspections when we called them. The mechanics on the facility warned truck drivers that they were taking bad order chassis. Some of the truck drivers then refused to take the chassis because the way the current law is, the truck driver is the sole responsible person for that chassis. Nobody else is, even though there's collusion possibly by a number of companies in moving those chassis over the road. I was basically, I don't want to say the word threatened, but I was told that if my mechanics that I represent continued to inform the truck drivers that some of these were bad order chassis, that they would try to deal with them through the grievance machinery. In other words, that we were interfering with the employer's business. That they didn't consummate that. It was simply a warning. Finally, on about the fourth day, the owner of 2B Trucking brought his own truck, took a bad order chassis, threatened our mechanics, took the chassis off the facility. We contacted ODOT. They pulled him over. They tagged the chassis and his truck and fined him heavily. Now, this doesn't go on every day where these truck drivers are getting fined, because there's not enough resources by ODOT to do it. They don't have the money. They got like one inspector, and you got to carve him out of whatever he's doing, okay? But I'm telling you that every day, a lot of trucks should do not belong on the road are going up and down those North Portland streets, and a lot of chassis are going up and down those North Portland streets. And the chassis are owned by people who are foreign companies, and it's like a big black hole out there. And all this is trying to do is get a handle on it and make those who own the chassis responsible, not just the poor individual truck drivers getting $35 to haul a chassis down the road, and he needs to get 4 or 5 trips in order to buy the gas and the tires for the truck that he allegedly owns.
Thank you. Quick questions.
Well, I'm just doing some simple math. I mean, and I still haven't heard an answer to the question, which is, there's been one accident.
I haven't researched that, but I'm not going to argue with that. I accept the what Mr. Egan says in that, and that being what the statistics are.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's driver error, equipment error, or
that's what they deem. My understanding of his testimony from the Transportation Committee was that was what they deemed to be equipment error. There's a number of accidents that have taken place that they deem to be, as I understand it, they deem to be driver error. I'm suggesting that those statistics don't mean anything in the sense, I mean, the driver error could also be equipment error. We just don't have the resources to investigate the accident to determine whether equipment error was a factor or even a contributing factor in those accidents. And given what I see every day, I'm sure they are.
Well, I mean, I'm just...
That's just my, from being there.
And this is probably way off base, I mean, because I don't understand the nature of the business. But I'm 500 chassis a day, 300 days a year, it's, you know, 150,000, 10,000, I mean, that times 10 years, I mean, that's 1,500,000 trips someplace, and we've got one accident or 10. I mean, I don't know. Anyway, I understand there's a time constraint. Thank you very much, both of you.
Thank you, Senator.
Senator Berger?
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to just take this to a little bit different level because I'm very sensitive to the cost that businesses incur to do business. So I have a sympathetic ear to that. But as a policymaker, I've just jotted down a few places that I vote to regulate. Industry with OSHA. Doesn't matter how many accidents they've had, they still have to incur the cost. Hospitals. Staff working conditions, the safety of the hospital, the safety of the worker, schools, same way. Automobiles, working conditions in the back shop. Cities, police and fire standards. Isn't based on how many accidents you've had. It is prevention of accidents that are to come. And as public policymakers, we touch all of these industries with safety. And so it just reaches a different level for me rather than the Port of Portland or this accusation. It is, as a public policy person, I have to look at the regulation of safety, and this goes along with all of the other industries that I've just mentioned.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What frequency is there in the turnaround of these chassis? If you have 500 a day, how many of them return within a month or a week or a year?
You get the port up after these gentlemen. If you have a,
I think that, and the port can tell, you know, argue with me. I think it just depends. Some of them you might see, some chassis you might see multiple times during the day. You might see them, the same chassis 5-6 times in the day. Other chassis you might see once. Some chassis then are left in the pool, you know, at the port, and then they change to get a chassis from a different company, because the way it works, if I'm picking up a Hanjin container, then I'm going to use a Hanjin chassis. And then if I continue to pick up, move Hanjin containers all day, I might use the same chassis. If I'm going to, you know, then maybe get a Hanjin container, maybe a K-Line container, I'm going to switch chassis to K-Line container. So it all depends. What we like about this bill, it isn't perfect, but over time, the fleet does go through the Port of Portland. So some are going to get inspected more often. The inspections don't take long. I witnessed inspections in New Jersey, as an example. By the time it takes them to clear their paperwork, the inspector has, you know, inspected the chassis. He's got a little handheld computer, and he punches in a code, and that's that. It's a very, it doesn't slow down commerce.
Follow up at all?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The way the language of the bill reads, as I understand it, is that each chassis will be inspected every time it leaves.
Yes.
So you're replicating inspections of chassis that could have been inspected two or three times a day or week or month.
That is correct. That is correct.
Mr. Chairman, follow
yes.
up?
Follow up.
With respect to checking brake systems, components, and operation, that implies that you're moving the vehicle, testing the brakes, looking at the cans in the back, seeing if they're adjusted. Suspension systems, you're looking at the center pins and the bogies, tires, wheels, vehicle connecting devices, glad hands, lights, and electrical systems. To me, in the experience that I've had in the trucking industry, that's much more than just a casual look at it, sign it off, and send it on its way. So in terms of time, I would, it would be my judgment that to do that thoroughly, incorrectly, that it would occupy a fair amount of time to do that.
Do you want to comment?
I think he's just commenting.
Okay.
But thank you very much. Appreciate you coming forward. Give you guys a chance to at least comment on some of the stats that were being requested. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And we'll want to keep this fairly
brief. I understand. I'm sure you're anxious as we are to move forward, Mr. Chair. If I could, I'll do a quick introduction here. And very much appreciating Senator Verger's comment on the importance of this to business, but also recognizing, and I have to say this as an overarching comment, again, can't emphasize this enough, safety is absolutely a goal, and it's a primary part of our strategic plan, and that is why, again, we're proud of the record that we have. It's also why we're supporting legislation on the federal level that has passed both the United States House and the United States Senate, different versions, but in the Transportation Reauthorization Bill, we're supporting that legislation along with the American Trucking Association, American Association of Railroads, and the Ocean Carrier Equipment Managers Association, and I provided a letter to you from them. They're very concerned with this legislation, and on the last page of that bill is the lineup of the carriers that we hope to have more of at the Port of Portland, which gets into the business case here. And I could not let the record stand with the questions on the numbers that we've put forward. And our CFO will speak to this in just a moment. But the easy math that I need to understand is the one inspector that does visual inspections today. And this is a shorter inspection, and I'm very glad you're reading the bill, because I was going to ask you to just look at Section 3 there and what all is involved every time one of these chassis comes through. The visual inspection that we do today is done by one FTE. That one FTE, because we are in the territory that we're in, costs $212,000 annually in wages, benefits, and OPE. Very significant cost. That person looks at about 10% of those chassis that come through. And that's a visual inspection. Again, that's a shorter inspection than checking the brakes, checking the suspension, checking the connections, doing everything that Senator Morse said would be required, and he's right, under this legislation, every time it comes through. So if you multiply that 10% out, you're then inspecting 100% of the chassis, and you're inspecting, doing a longer inspection. We actually think 15 is a very conservative number, not to mention the cost to business. The cost to business is how long does it take that truck to turn every time. I just spoke this morning with a fellow with the grass seed growers, and he said he would be very concerned with this legislation because they try to get 3 turns a day with their equipment today. With this, wouldn't happen. You would be stuck, and Marine Drive would be stuck, and we absolutely would need to have a facility out there. So I'll stop talking. I'm just going to do a quick introduction of our CFO and Director of Operations.
Reintroduce yourself.
Oh, I'm sorry. Pat Egan with the Port of Portland. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Correct. Hi, I'm Steve Schreiber. I'm the Chief Financial Officer with the Port of Portland. And just to expand a little bit on Pat's comments, I think we've actually tried to be somewhat conservative in the numbers. We don't differ, I don't think, on the number of containers we're looking at that move through the terminal each day. We've estimated around 500, between 500 and 600 containers a day. We've assumed, I think again conservatively, that it would take about 15 minutes to do the inspection. That's probably on the short side of things, but again, to be somewhat conservative on costs. Our marine terminal is managed by a company called MTC, Marine Terminals Corporation. We contract with them for labor at Terminal 6 where the inspections would take place, and we pay them about $85 an hour for this type of labor. So if you do the math, kind of multiply it out, and we agree we didn't include weekends and holidays, you come up with a range of somewhere between $3 to $5 million a year. We did not include in that any costs for management, training, building costs. Were not included in that number at all. That's just kind of pure labor cost associated with the inspection. So we feel that that's a very realistic number.
Very good. Appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Senator, Dave Nelson, want to come up? So right ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dave Nelson. I'm the Executive Secretary of the Oregon Seed Council. Over the course of the past 30 years, we've had an enormous political battle, environmental political battle, over the practice of open field burning in the state of Oregon, particularly in the Willamette Valley. We currently grow about 800 million pounds of grass seed on over 500,000 acres in the state of Oregon. One of the biggest problems in converting away from the practice of open field burning is, what do you do with 1 million tons of straw annually? And through the course of the last 15 or 20 years, what developed is an exporting program, exporting grass seed straw to Japan, Korea, and Taiwan. And I'd like to introduce Mr. Steve Van Maurik, who is the Oregon Operations Manager of Anderson Hay Company, one of the largest exporters of Oregon grass seed straw to the Pacific Rim. We've grown to the point where we're now exporting around 600,000 tons of straw annually. That converts into roughly 25,000 containers a year. That's over 100 containers a day. So Mr. Van Maurik can tell you about the problems that the grass seed industry and the straw exporting industry would have with Senate Bill 1007.
Dave, thank you. Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you. My name is Steve Van Maurik. In addition to being the division manager for Anderson Hay in Oregon, I'm also vice president of our Oregon Ag Fiber Association, which is our straw exporters association. And I'm co-chair of our National Hay Association's Export Processors Committee, where we manage various issues that we share with our Japanese and Korean and Taiwanese customer countries. Our industry ships all types of hay and straws from all of the ports up and down the West Coast into those markets. We're essentially a backhaul business for everything that is coming to you through Walmart and Target and the like. In that sense, we rely on the lowest possible transportation costs. We're typically a high-volume business with a low margin that we try to retain. Anderson Hay ships about 7,000 containers a year of grass straw out of the Willamette Valley, and about 20,000 from all of our West Coast ports of different types of hay. Our entire industry ships about 100,000 containers a year out of Long Beach, San Francisco, Portland, and Tacoma, Seattle. The 600,000 tons of straw that are exported from here represent 300,000 acres of fields that are not being burned. And it's been a very serendipitous and fortunate set of circumstances that here in the Willamette Valley over the last 20 years, we've been able to forge a marketplace solution to an environmental problem like this. Our plant in Aurora, just up from Woodburn, puts about 30 containers a day into the market through an ocean intermodal yard of some kind. And our industry is doing 100 containers a day. Our trucks need to make 4 turns a day. Those are just the harsh economics of what we're trying to do. And our concern is that as we're trying to manage our cost structure, as we have to compete every day with Chinese rice straw and Australian oat straw, we're confronted with higher costs of operation to get that job done. Our second concern is redundancy. We're complying with the over-the-road requirements of ODOT and highway safety. We're subject to inspection. We have Les Schwab out every day checking our tires and maintaining those chassis. There are a lot of systems in place, both privately and regulatorily, already for chassis safety. And third, we are really behind our port, which is struggling. We've lost so many carriers. Too many of our containers are going up to Seattle and Tacoma instead of out of the Port of Portland. Adding additional costs of operation to the Port of Portland is harmful to our efforts to maintain access to our markets. We strongly oppose this redundant and inefficient activity proposed in this bill. Thank you very much for hearing our thoughts.
Thank you guys very much. I think what the chair wants to do, we're actually engaging the fiscal concerns here. We don't want to relive the entire discussion, and maybe there'll be opportunity to deal with that in the future. We all understand there's a cost. That's why the bill has been assigned to Ways and Means. The cost to the state's minimal, as I understand, from LFO. You want to expand on that a little bit?
Mr. Chair, the information I got from ODOT indicated that it would probably be well under $50,000, and it looks like it'd be approximately $10,000 or so to comply with those requirements. The other fiscal we got was from the Judicial department, and theirs was connected with the two violations that are spoke to in the bill, coercing or retaliating against a driver that reported an unsafe chassis and or else interfering with the tagging of the chassis. And theirs was indeterminate, but they felt that it wouldn't be very significant at all. They didn't expect it to increase their court costs, their operative costs.
Very good. I guess what the chair would hope would be possible is for us to move this bill out of committee, understanding there's going to be another opportunity to debate this either at full or on the floor, with the full body weighing in on the safety and actual costs to the Port of Portland is what looks like to be the issue. The chair would entertain a motion, Senator Berger.
Mr. Chair, I so move.
Senator Berger moves Senate Bill 1007 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Mr. Morse, would you like to comment?
I will extend a courtesy vote to the chair to move this to the floor.
Appreciate that very much.
I reserve the right to the floor debate and making a decision on the floor.
Cool.
Are we moving this to the floor or to the full committee?
Oh, excuse me. Well, either way, it has to move.
I appreciate that.
I'll extend a courtesy no.
Well, thank you, Senator. Your full service. Okay, any further discussion? We'll record Senator Westland as an objection and a courtesy vote from Senator Morse, which we appreciate. Moves to full. Thank you, everybody, for your testimony. Appreciate it. Senator Berger.
To both. Full and
yeah.
Four.
Yeah. We have one more item on our agenda, Senate Bill 1048, relating to the coordination of social service efforts. We'll switch people here.
Mr. Chair, before we get going, I'd just like to ask, does Representative Dingfelter have anything to do with this bill?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 1048 is before you this afternoon. It establishes the Ending Homelessness Advisory Council within Housing and Community Services. Establishes a separate account separate from the general funds, and that account may accept donations and grants. Expands membership on an interagency council and expands the membership of the Hunger Relief Task Force. The interagency council would support both the Ending Homelessness Advisory and Hunger Relief Task Force. There is a fiscal associated with this bill that was just handed out. While the bill itself does not prescribe contributions by the interagency coordinating council agencies, there is apparently an unwritten understanding that agencies that are membership or have membership in this council will contribute $8,000 per year to the Housing and Community Services Department. And it's my understanding from the agency that they will then contract out services to a local provider.
Very good. Well, I'll get the agency to come up real quick and that'd be a good idea, because let's have the HC come up and talk very, 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 very briefly about what LFO just said for the record, and then Senator Dingfelter will be leisurely brief in her comments, and then we'll get everyone else up to and so they can have their brief comments also on the fiscal aspects of this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Housing Community Services.
Isn't that enough for Mr. Repine?
To the committee staff's comments about the funding mechanism, it has been the general practice within the current structure of the statutes where the configuration of the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger, which is kind of the same of the design, where there has been a $8,000 annual contribution by agencies that participate at this. It comes either as a direct cash contribution In some agencies, they may not have that ability, so they might give us an amount of money and do some printing costs to offset costs. So it's kind of a bartering. It's kind of an old traditional, not a hardcore deal, but it's a gentleman's handshake amongst the members to coordinate at a relatively small amount of money, and it's been very successful over the last 8 years.
Very good. Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd just like to thank you and the committee members for hearing this bill today. I certainly appreciate it, given the lateness of the session. I came to lend support for this bill. I'm not going to speak on the fiscal aspects. That's why I now Director Repine's leaving, but I was going to say that's why I had asked Director Repine to be up there with me. But just very briefly, I'd like to say why I'm here today and in support of the bill. Some of you probably know that I serve on the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force, and this new council would coordinate activity to end homelessness in Oregon, and this is a concern of the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. You probably know that there's been a steady increase in homelessness in the past 10 years. And by the way, for the record, Representative Jackie Dingfelder, Northeast Portland, House District 45, I apologize. This increase, we're not sure if it's attributable to increased unemployment, decline in the state's economy, higher housing costs, or a combination of all these factors. But the fact remains that today we have 8,500 homeless Oregonians on any day of the year. And sadly, about 35% of the homeless are children. You know, I find that a very unfortunate statistic. And there are multiple agencies, as you have heard, that deal with various aspects of homelessness. Despite many efforts of our noble state agencies to individually address homelessness, Oregon has fallen short of its homelessness benchmarks. So what we're currently lacking is a means to coordinate each of the different efforts in a collaborative, streamlined plan to address and eventually prevent homelessness. And this is what we hope this bill will do by creating an advisory committee to coordinate these activities. And this new council will be composed, as you probably see in the bill, legislators, nonprofits, advocates, and business professionals, along with state agency staff working on homelessness issues. The bill briefly outlines specific responsibilities for the council. It is including but not limited to the designated state entity planning for ending homelessness in Oregon. So this entity will be that. Developing a 10-year plan to end homelessness. Developing specific proposals and recommendations for action by the governor and legislature. We didn't want this just to be a feel-good body that meets. We really wanted some benchmarks and action items for these agencies to work towards. So we believe that this new council can be an effective statewide program to combat homelessness and elevate dialogue about the issue in the state. This bill will also increase the membership of the Interagency Coordinating Council on Hunger, and this council is currently responsible for increasing agency cooperation on hunger issues and implementing recommendations of the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. So this expanded council will be tasked with implementing the recommendations of the Homelessness Advisory Council as well. You've already heard about the fiscal. I really believe that this would be an important step forward in Oregon. We have lots of activities going on, but we're not very good at getting a handle on who's doing what and coordinating those. So I think this is a very important bill, and I urge your support.
Very good. Thank you for your comments.
Thank you again for hearing this, and I really will be here to answer any questions if I can.
Ms. Jones, do you have comments?
I'd just like to add one aspect. My name is Jody Jones, Assistant Manager for Community Services Section of the Oregon Housing and Community Services Department, Chairman Schrader, and the rest of the committee. I'm here to offer testimony in support of Senate Bill 1048, which will improve the coordination of planning and services for addressing hunger and homelessness in the state. One of the aspects that has not been covered yet is the impact it will have on the actual clients that we serve. By the time many of the clients that are seeking assistance reach our doors, they are in need of multiple services ranging anywhere from transportation, employment, shelter, food, mental health services, and so forth. What ends up happening is many of our agencies currently have plans to address targeted populations and the services that they end up giving. What that impacts for the clients is not only the providers, but the clients end up working with multiple case plans that often duplicate each other or conflict with each other. So what we've caused the clients to do is try to maneuver through the various systems that we have. We have multiple agencies that have various pieces to the puzzle in order to serve the clients, but we just don't have anywhere to put the puzzle together. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I've already submitted my written testimony to you, so I don't need to disclose and talk any more of that. I think there's some other people who would like to make their comments.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, before this panel leaves, I just like to say, Ms. Jones, I don't know you well enough at all. I know the guy sitting next to you way too well.
Okay.
But, Jackie, this reflects the excellent, excellent work that we've all come to expect from you, and I just want to compliment you, all of you, on your efforts in putting this together. This is great. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Westland, and I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge the many folks behind me who are going to come up, because the advocates and the folks from many of the agencies you're going to hear from who work tirelessly really deserve the bulk of the credit. And we did try to, we came forward with a advisory committee last session that unfortunately we didn't get funded, so this is our second go-round at this, but we think this is a much improved version, and we're really excited to be here with this proposal, and I appreciate your support.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, also before this panel leaves.
Sure, guys, just keep on going. That's just fine.
And likewise with Senator Westland, I endorse this effort. Did you consider combining the hunger task force and this activity in just an expanded scope, because the nexus between hunger and homelessness has to be there. I'm just curious when I read the bill.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Morris, yes, that discussion was debated relatively heavily when we were coming up with the language for this bill. There are many close ties between the homelessness and the hunger issues, but there are as many places where they connect, they become disconnected too. So we wanted to make sure that the focus for both of those still had a presence and a high priority within the agencies. So the process that we will indulge or take on if this bill is passed is to convene, if you notice, most of these people as far as representatives are the same as far as agency-wide. Then you'll have the task force and the advisory council who will be representing the hunger side and the homeless side, but they'll be bringing that information back to the larger group, the larger table, to have the final discussion and the final framing of the issues to either be advanced as legislative solutions, governor recommendations, or legislative recommendations. So they will come together, they will work individually, but then they will come back together at the greater table so everybody can get their heads around the topic in a more broader sense of what the issues are, be it hunger or be it homelessness. So I think, at least in my mind, as I've been chairing this group for the last 8 years, this approach will work very well. We do this even in the hunger aspect. When you think about hunger, it breaks down into different aspects. As an example, we had a debate this morning in the committee. We were talking about supplement food programs for schools, along with the WIC farmers market programs. Distinctively, two different components of hunger issues that need to be vetted out in specific discussions, but brought back together because they are both in the greater context of issues around hunger.
Thank you.
Very good. Senator Berger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. In a speech recently, Bishop Story said that public service is the rent you pay for the space that you occupy in this universe. And as I sat here listening to you, I couldn't help but think that the height of public service is to help those who are struggling to get a space in this universe, and I really commend you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Senator.
You all very much. Appreciate that. Why don't we get Ms. Wise, Ms. Elverding, and Mr. Morris come on up, please. Go ahead, Patty.
Thank you.
Right
for
up.
The record, Patty Whitney Wise, the Executive Director of the Oregon Hunger Relief Task Force. We have participated in the development of this parallel group, and just so that you know, we plan to work very closely with those working on the homeless issue. There are many, many realms of issues around hunger and homelessness separately, and I'm passing out to you not only my testimony, but a copy of our Act to End Hunger. Mm-hmm. It's 40 ways in 5 years to make a difference. It's a strategic plan developed in cooperation with the governor's office. And in there, we list some of the housing policies that are affecting hunger, but it is a very short list because that's not our area of expertise. And we think that by helping to mentor this new group coming together around homelessness and helping them follow the direction we have in hunger, that we then can come together under the Interagency Coordinating Council, which will now be on hunger and homelessness, and bridge those issues together. There's a lot of work that needs to be done on each of those. So we very strongly endorse this plan, and we're here to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for your good work.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mike Morris, and I'm the Mental Health Policy Manager for the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services, which is in the Department of Human Services. And I've submitted our written testimony, and I just want to briefly state that we support this bill. We have many efforts to address the homelessness issue in regards to individuals with mental illness, and we want to acknowledge the leadership that the Oregon Housing and Community Services has taken to bring this bill forward.
Thank you. Very good. Thank you for the acknowledgement there. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Wendy Van Elverdeen. I'm the Executive Director of Community Action Directors of Oregon. We now represent the whole state with 18 community action agencies. And we're also here urging your support of this bill. The piece of my testimony that I would like to point out to you is the third page, which is a graph that talks about how things have changed since the war on poverty started 40 years ago, and why things that would have helped poverty 40 years ago no longer work. Such things as one adult working full-time was enough to pull a family out of poverty. That's no longer true. The other one that I think is extremely important is that social class didn't used to be an important issue, and now in order to get a non-poverty wage job, you have to have at least middle class communication skills, social skills. So those are major barriers that weren't around 40 years ago that have changed. And by bringing together the hunger piece and the housing piece, we can start to look at the full network of services needed to bring a family out of poverty. We urge your support, and thank you.
I appreciate that last page of your testimony. It's pretty interesting, actually, when you look at that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Anyone else need to comment on Senate Bill 1048? Looks like a good piece of legislation. Any further discussion by the committee?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
I move Senate Bill 1048 to the full Senate Budget Committee with a do-pass recommendation.
Further discussion? Objection? Seeing none? So ordered. We are adjourned. Thank you all very much for your patience.